This podcast is sponsored by Athletic Greens. Now, you've probably heard of Athletic Greens from 1,000 different podcasts, and the reason why I believe is because it works. This is something I've been using every single day, and the biggest things that I've realized for myself is that I have more energy, I rarely if ever get sick, my poops are better, okay? There's multiple benefits here, and if you are interested in trying it, I have a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 AG1 travel packs by using the link drinkag1.com/Farzad. And my gut tells me, no pun intended, that you're going to love this product. Now onto the podcast.
We need fewer Kim Kardashians and more Elon Musks. Kim Kardashian's not an evil person, but Kim Kardashian's contributions to society as a whole are not as positive as Elon Musk's. Like, that should not be a controversial thing to say, that the person who is going to make space travel accessible to normal everyday people over the next 50 years is a much better person to be than Kim Kardashian.
A few moments later,
Johnny Harris is a asshole, and I can't believe he came out with this bull video, and we're going to talk about it.
Watch this. I think it's interesting having somebody like him do a piece on Elon, because I think it kind of gives a sort of a window into how someone from maybe like the moderate left, I would say, or maybe like the left, I think it's clear that he has a left-leaning bias, especially when he said, you know, Twitter that Twitter was actually amplifying conservative voices more than liberal voices, based on that study that he showed.
Yeah, it's like, you obviously weren't a conservative over the last 5 years and had any experience of what that felt like.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Not only that, but like, you know, if I'm on the Twitter homepage at the time, and it didn't matter what I viewed, everything was left-leaning bias. Everything was like, every single thing that was served to me algorithmically was left-leaning. And listen, I'm not saying left-leaning stuff is good or bad. I'm just saying that's what it was. So that was interesting to hear from his viewpoint. I thought the way he captured the first half, like the story arc of him, mm-hmm. up to Twitter, I thought it was the best job anyone has done outside of like the Musk sphere, like people that really follow him closely. I thought he did a really good job with that,
especially for like the amount of time that he devoted to it. Like, that is probably one of the better, like, you know, 20-minute recaps that exists, period, anywhere, including inside the Musk sphere of the history.
I agree 100%. But I thought the Twitter stuff, it kind of fell apart from my viewpoint. Something, yeah, like that could happen. Forget it. Like, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy, right?
Obviously, I had, you know, heard when you sent the message, your kind of high-level perspective, that he had done a good job but missed the mark on the Twitter stuff. So I went into it listening kind of with that context. I was very impressed with, like you said, how factual he was for the groundwork. But the piece is obviously designed to get down to the heart of, you know, what's Elon's purpose behind purchasing X and how's he doing? And I would say that I would agree. It seems like he is writing this from the perspective of someone who is from the left. And that does color his things. I would disagree with him on a number of points of fact, and I think as you would. But one of the things that I actually appreciate is, like, I feel like this is a very fair steel man of the left's argument about why they have a beef with Elon right now, from a very rational and you know, grounded perspective, that, you know, this isn't someone who's just like flying off the handle at him. Like, this is someone who's presenting probably one of the best fact-based arguments that is a counter position to Elon's feelings and impositions and, you know, stated policies and stuff, that I think that Elon would be very well served by fully reading or listening to and digesting the points that are being made. Even if not all of the points that are being made are completely valid, But just, you know, I would say from that perspective, I was pretty impressed. It leads me to some questions. So, you know, a number of his points were that, you know, Elon is trying to make X a free speech platform, and that there are a number of ways in which he's arguing that it is less of a free speech platform now under Elon than it was pre-Elon. And there are some things that he cites in support of that position. To me, it seems like they're cherry-picked data points, citing sources that I would never trust in a million years, given the amount of institutional lying that we have experienced over the last 6 years, especially. But, you know, much longer than that. So, you know, when you're citing a Harvard review person and maybe the fact that they have taken down some of these services that they used to provide, that as a point of fact is not going to be in dispute, their overall perspective on how easy it is to monitor how free discourse is on X. Like, you know, they were giving it flying grades when I think that was, you know, an unfair characterization. And yeah, like I said, I would disagree with him on a number of points as it relates to X. So I guess that was kind of my overall reaction to it. And honestly, I think he would be a great person if he'd be willing to come on the podcast. And then like we could come with facts in hand and just have a good discussion about it. At least in the piece as delivered, it seemed like he was the type of person who's capable of a good, you know, honest, reasoned discussion and would be fair. And I think, you know, if we could have the types of conversations that we normally have on this podcast, I think that would go well. But just because, you know, it was a very obviously highly edited piece, that doesn't necessarily mean that he could pull that off in a, you know, a long form discussion the same way that it comes off in a produced YouTube video.
The thing that's really interesting to me about that piece is like, I think it's important, you know, because it really made my sort of mind start to think, or, you know, it really made me start thinking about what the picture could look like as Elon Musk continues to make Tesla larger, SpaceX larger, Neuralink larger, Boring Company, his sphere of influence is already very large and his sphere of power is very large, and it's only going to continue to grow. Especially, you know, if you're somebody who follows the story closely, if you believe self-driving cars are going to be successful, if you believe Starship, the massively reusable rocket that's going to plummet the price of space stuff even more than it already has, if you think that's going to be successful, if you think the human or robot's going to be successful, these are multi-trillion dollar industries, multi-10 trillion dollar industries potentially in the next 10, 20 years that will give them so much money and access to resources. It's unbelievable. Like he has the potential to be, like if you look at the top 10 countries in the world by GDP, he might be in the top 10. From a net worth perspective, right? In the next 5 to 10 years, if he's successful, right? And I think that starts a conversation around, okay, so let's give Elon the benefit of the doubt and say he is well-intentioned, he will execute properly for humanity, all that good stuff, right? Shouldn't there also be a counterforce to ensure that's being done the bigger he gets, right? And that's kind of where my head goes to, right? As somebody who's a fan of the guy and a fan of his companies, you know, I've openly been supportive, right, of the stuff he's doing. And I give him the benefit of the doubt. I trust the guy. People are like, well, how can you trust him? You never met him. Yeah, I think that's fair. But just based on the execution of his companies, I have and having worked as one of his companies, experiencing that culture up close, I lean towards trusting him, right? But I think as he becomes more and more powerful, I think the onus is on him to ensure that these are being deployed, these resources are being deployed for the good of humanity. And I think what the Twitter acquisition has made a little murky for some, right? I still think I still think there's clear improvements, especially against the stated goal of the platform, which is to improve free speech, that 1,000% have been executed against. And the clearest example that I can use is that on his own platform, I've never seen more Elon Musk hate on Twitter X than now. And so one can say, you know, if he really was this anti-free speech guy, why is he allowing the flourishing of hatred against the guy on his own platform? And a lot of it gets amplified to millions of people, right? So it's like you can see it in front of your face. I'm like, okay, so that's an interesting viewpoint. I do think people like Johnny and other people that do have counterpoints that are able to bring forward that could potentially say, hey, Elon's going down the wrong path here and Elon should rethink this, or Elon's just being downright wrong or unethical about this, right? I think those voices increasingly become more important the more power he gets, right? And this is like, regardless of how well-intentioned or really positive somebody can be, if we're human by default, we are subject to imperfections and being corrupted, right? So even the most well-intentioned person could end up doing the wrong thing. And the more power an individual gets, the more amplified the mistakes will be. Something that I learned at Tesla firsthand, the smartest people in the world, I think, work at that company. I really do think so. And the smartest people in the world, when they have had such a streak of incredible successes and good calls, they will confidently go into a really stupid decision and it will have an outsized impact on the downside. And so the question becomes, how quickly are they able to correct that mistake? And how long lasting are those mistakes? I don't think this is any different for Elon, right? And this is what this video made me think about. Like, it really did. Like, it got my gears turning from that perspective. Even with some of the, I believe, you know, in my opinion, sort of incorrect framing or just downright incorrect sort of premises that were presented, I still feel like it was done in good faith from his perspective. And it generated a healthy discussion in my head, especially as this arc continues in the next 5-10 years, because it's coming. I mean, like, I don't think we can, you know, people will say, well, robotaxis, you self-driving. I'm like, that's such a stupid conversation. It's going to happen. We don't know when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen. So once it happens and that technology underpins the human or robot, what does that look like? That's the right question. You know,
I agree. And I agree with pretty much all of those points. I think that obviously what you're describing is the absolute necessity of checks and balances, that it's impossible to set up a healthy system without proper checks and balances. And yeah, the more powerful, the more successful you get, the more important those checks and balances become. And not only are they more important, but they're also harder to set up because the reality distortion, like success and especially resources, allow you to create a massive reality distortion field around yourself. Even if you are like, even when you're actively trying to mitigate that reality distortion bubble, your power, success, and access to resources just automatically creates one around you that is very, very hard to properly address and mitigate. And yeah, I would agree that that's something that Elon needs to continue to have a strong finger on. One of the things that, you know, Johnny cited in his piece was the fact that, you know, he feels like Twitter isn't fighting these takedown requests by foreign governments enough. And he cited Turkey as an example of one where they just kind of rolled over. And in the past, I guess Twitter did fight some of those things there in Turkey and they were shut off for a period of time. I would say, okay, if you're going to make that point, maybe that's a fair point. Why are you not also citing what's going on in Brazil, which they are fighting those? And so, you know, you can't say that they're not fighting things at all just because in one place they fought it before and now they are not choosing to fight it there. They're choosing to fight it in a different place. And then the other thing that you also have to consider is that, you know, pre-Elon, the financial picture at Twitter that allowed them to do some of these things was much different than it has been of late. And, you know, I wouldn't judge the ambitions of X to be the free speech platform while they are in a little bit more of a precarious situation financially, that it, hopefully as they grow in resources, they do better on that front and not worse. But if they're not, they definitely need to be held to account. They definitely need to have their feet held to the fire. They need to be criticized for those things. And I think it is fair to criticize the fact that they have fought the takedown requests in Turkey before and they're not now. Like, I think that is a fair criticism to make. But if you're, you know, talking to a general audience, don't try to say, based on that point, that X doesn't care about fighting takedown requests anymore when they are fighting takedown requests, just not the same, you know, in the same location. You know, as we think about all of the ways that technology is changing and the massive implications of growing labor force and, you know, the economic changes that come along with that, the ability for humanity as a whole to have much more access to resources, to goods, to services, on the back of things like Robotaxi and Optimus robots. That transition is going to be a difficult and chaotic transition. And the people who are at the forefront of leading that transition definitely do not need to be shielded from criticism. So I think your point about him allowing, for the most part, his critics to have the ability to say whatever they want on his platform, while even, you know, you can also validly say there have been occasions in the past where he has taken action to silence a few of those people. I mean, if you just step back and say, hey, this is a human, he's not going to be perfect, it is understandable that, like, man, I can listen to criticisms a lot. And most of them feel like, okay, yeah, you know, I hear this one, I hear that one, this one's fair, that one's not fair. And it not really, really, you know, penetrate the armor, but sometimes it does. And when it does, sometimes you act like a human acts in that situation. So, you know, it is understandable also that he would do some of those things, but that doesn't take away from the point that people can still criticize him. And I think Elon, I mean, it's hard to say. It seems like he's fairly aware of the gripes and criticisms that people level at him. And, you know, I don't think that he is trying to shield himself from them in any way, shape, or form, and that he's not taking steps to, you know, incorporate positive, you know, legitimate critical feedback into improvements in the future.
One of the things I've seen on X is, you know, if you remember when he first acquired Twitter up to, like, say, a few months ago, the tone from him, I think a lot of people were concerned he was being too divisive. It was very inflammatory. Some of the tweets were quite inflammatory. It was quite uncomfortable for a lot of people. And it was literally in the midst of a Tesla stock going down to $100 a share. People were up in arms. I remember making a video when that was happening. I was like, hey, you do you, free speech. I support free speech. But just be aware how a base of investors that you've been very close to, all of a sudden you've hit them with this curveball and they're all like, what just happened, right? Like, not all of them are going to understand where you're coming from or what you're trying to do, right or wrong. Like, and you know, it's going to be difficult to have the whole picture in mind. You will cause chaos, right? I remember making, and I did it on Herbert's channel. I think Herbert had me on his channel. He interviewed me. I was like, listen, this is, I don't know if he's mindful. If he wants the advice, take it. I even posted it on X and I tagged him. I'm like, here's your advice. Take it or leave it, right? Now it seems like the approach, you know, some people will take issue with, like, well, he's spreading, you know, conspiracy theories or whatever, you know? But like at least from my standpoint, it seems a lot more measured. It's a lot more nuanced. I think it harbors more discussion instead of just like throwing something out there. And like it's trying to harbor discussion. Some of them are very difficult topics. Some of them are very divisive topics, right? But at least I'm seeing that. So there is a trend. So I think it's going to be very important for him to continue on that trend, you know, to somehow, and I've been thinking about this concept so much, to somehow arrive to true neutral or true unbiased and true fairness as much as possible, because that's ultimately, I think, if you think you know, a person or a human, I think it's impossible to reach true unbiased. I think everybody's biased. I think every single person on the planet, even if they say they're unbiased, they're biased. Like, there's a spectrum of bias, you know, but we're all biased. You know, obviously I'm biased pro Elon, pro Tesla, so on and so forth, right?
I mean, I don't like the word bias necessarily in this context, because while it's a fair word to use, there's another word for it that helps you to understand. Like, bias equals perspective. Like, we all sure. have a perspective. There are things that we know that other people don't know. There are things that other people know that we don't know. And those sets of base facts and experiences and perceptions of reality provide us with the perspective that we have. And yes, we all have a perspective. And, you know, I, the reason that I push back on the use of the word bias in this instance is that it does have such a negative connotation a lot of times that comes with it. And, you know, if you're just saying that everyone has bias, if you want to strip the negative connotation out of it, just say everyone has their own perspective. And I think people are a little bit more receptive to understanding, oh yeah, you know, I have my own perspective.
Yeah, no, that's 100% fair. But I think he's in a unique position having X and, you know, being the one that's trying to push for free speech, to really try to arrive to a point where, and he may have already reached that point, right? And I'm trying to, like, understand, you know, as somebody who's trying to extrapolate where this is all going, this is ultimately what this channel is all about, is like, where is this all going? Where is self-driving technology going? Where is electric vehicles going? Where is human or robots going? Where is, you know, neural brain interface? You know, these like cutting edge technologies, where are they going? And how is this central person who happens to be at the forefront of fucking all of them, where is he going to end up as all those things go to that place, right? I think with X specifically, he's in a unique position to really try and be a uniter of the majority of the population, because he has had this streak of being capable of inspiring so many people before that. You know, I mean, I think it's fair to say that before Twitter, the percentage of the population that liked them, the percentage of it as like versus dislike of the population before Twitter was probably higher. It was probably closer to 80% than 50%. But I think post-Twitter acquisition, the net number of people who like him is significantly higher. I think of the people that were following his arc before Twitter, I think more people liked him than didn't. After Twitter, I think the number of people that like him is like 10 times more than before Twitter. Does that make any sense? But the percentage of people that don't like him is much higher, because all of a sudden he entered this bubble that's 100 times greater than pre-Twitter acquisition. And maybe that was the plan. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm somewhat skeptical. I think that for the vast majority of people who had ever heard Elon's name before Twitter, they heard it through mostly negative coverage in the media. Although I guess, you know, there was a season where it was positive. You know, he was Time Person of the Year. So I guess...
Do you remember when it was?
2020, wasn't it?
When Tesla stock went up. Yeah. It's amazing how that happens. It's amazing how stock price influences people's opinions so much.
So I guess I'm not saying that I don't believe that the percentage was higher before. I'm saying I don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I could definitely see, based on all the FUD that I experienced, like, you know, we definitely know this as long-term Tesla shareholders, that 99 conversations out of 100 that you would have about someone, or, you know, about Elon with someone who wasn't an owner and didn't know, was just fighting constant FUD and negativity. So, you know, I don't know what their perception of Elon was in all of that. But I definitely, you know, 100%, so many people are exposed to him now that, you know, never would have heard of him before. And one of the things that I'm excited about is the point that we discussed yesterday, that as, you know, X grows as a platform that more people use for more reasons, eventually, you know, becoming more of that everything app. But beyond that, as more and more people experience robo-taxis and that robo-taxis offer them the ability to have transportation at a cost that is dramatically lower than anything they've had in the past, that is a positive net benefit in their life. Huge, like hugely positive net benefit in their life. And then that we follow on that with the Optimus robots and they experience the positives of that. I mean, it's hard for me to think clearly about what public perception will be of Tesla and Elon as Optimus robots roll out, whether it will be positive or negative. You know, it's going to be really scary at first. I think it's probably going to go through peaks and valleys. I think before, as it becomes real, but before the impact has really hit, it will be extremely negative sentiment around Optimus. Then as we realize, hey, these things can't do all this crazy crap that people were expecting it to do, and I am starting to see some benefits, then it will kind of come back to a little bit more positive. Basically the opposite of the trough of despair. Like Bud will go through the trough of despair, where it'll peak, and then actually this isn't such a big deal. And then as things just continue to get better and better and better and progress, people will get more and more worried again. That's kind of my guess, my rough estimate of how sentiment around Optimus will go. But that will be on top of, hey, you know, I think robo-taxis will be largely positive. I think that there will be some FUD around it, but I don't think, you know, most people don't give two rips about Uber or Yellow Cab or, you know, any of these things. Most people just say, hey, I want, you know, it's not a personal threat to them that robo-taxis are going to provide them with way cheaper access to transport. So that fact will allow, I think, the majority of especially, you know, urban Western, like your New Yorks, your Los Angeles, your San Francisco, Austin, Miami, you know, all your centers of culture will be the first places where this service just dramatically alters everyday life. And I think we'll have a related positive impact on the perception of Elon in the minds of the public.
That's an interesting point. I take it a different way. I think as the masses adopt the technology, the link of the product to Elon becomes looser and weaker because it becomes transactional. How many people use Amazon? They're like, oh, that Jeff Bezos guy is awesome. Or like, you know, remember when Jeff Bezos made Amazon, right? Or like, you know, they use Windows. They'd be like, man, I love Bill Gates, you know, or Steve Ballmer or the currency. I forget his name, but he's a beast.
Nadella.
Yeah, Satya Nadella. There you go. Thank you. I think it becomes weaker and looser the more down market they go.
I'm going to disagree with you on that one. While I love the point, it is a great point. Those products, I don't think people understand how revolutionary those products were. And Steve Jobs is the counterpoint to what you're saying. And Steve Jobs gave something that was completely unique, completely special, completely differentiated from a design perspective. And like, you know, the iPhone came out of nowhere and everyone friggin' loves this dang thing. And Steve Jobs becomes one of the most loved figures in all of tech history, period, on the back of that.
And that's a good point, too, because if you look at Cybertruck, how many pieces do you see of media out there that are like, look at Elon's truck? You know, it's funny because people that say, look at Elon's truck, they're like, look at how ugly it is, right? But then you see this flood of celebrities and influencers and NBA players and sports people and athletes, they're all posting their wrapped Cybertruck freaking everywhere. You're like, wow, okay, cool. That's pretty awesome.
I mean, you just can't beat originality. And I think that maybe is maybe that's a good way to phrase what I was saying earlier. Like Steve Jobs was exceptional about being an original. And, you know, is Jeff Bezos an exceptional original? Yeah, I don't think so. You know, was especially not, you know, Bill Gates, 100% not great at being an original. so a lot of these people that we have distaste for, I feel like it's because there's a perception that they were inauthentic, and inauthentic by way of being copycats and then profiting off of being a copycat versus being an actual innovator. Now, I don't know that that's a fair characterization of those people, but I think that's kind of the general perception and attitude.
I think that's a very fair point. And I agree with you. I think you changed my mind on that, because if I look at one of the things that we do on the channel, I know people that watch this channel are probably very familiar with these, but we do these compilations of unique people that are well known talking about Elon Musk. So we did Jordan Peterson, we did Joe Rogan, we did a Trump one, we did another one. I forget which one it was, but we've done a series of these. And the thing that's very interesting is that there's a lot of very influential people that with very large audiences who recognize the uniqueness of that individual, the unique impact on society that he has had. You know, there's this one saying, somebody, you know, when they're talking to me about one of my friends, we were talking about Elon, I don't know, a year or so ago, and like something he said really resonated with me. He's like, there are unique people in history. If you go back 100, 200 years, there are names that come up, good or bad, that you're like, wow, this person was part of the age. Albert Einstein, right? Freaking Adolf Hitler. Okay, there's these names that come up that are, and I used a very good example and a very bad example. Okay, I'm trying to be unbiased, Hans. Okay, so but you have these like unique names, unique people that were a standout of that age, of that decade, of that time, and you know, Steve Jobs. Obviously, Steve Jobs is another one, right? I don't think he's a business person icon. He's like, I think, you know, most people know who he is. Michael Jordan, Michael Jackson. You know, you can go down the list. Freaking the Beatles is a group, but like everybody knows the Beatles, right? You can go down the list. Elvis Presley. there are names out there that stand out. And so I really think if Elon is in that category, right? And I think, you know, people like us who follow his space closely probably will say with a lot of confidence that, you know, in 50 years time or 40 years time when he's no longer around, whatever that is, whatever that time is, it's quite likely that the history books will look back and say, this guy was a person of his time, because he was able to create so many new things in his time that were so different from everything else, and he was able to stand out from those things. So if that's the case, then what you're saying is 100% true. And whatever is created from that person, product, service, whatever, influence, then that thing will be tied to that person. And so then we have to think about that within the context of world's first trillionaire, if that's the case. How does that go? How many riots will there be for that?
Yeah. To argue against myself, you know, the one thing that, while Elon is definitely an original, and that is much more like Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs was a bit of an asshole, and Elon can definitely be a bit of an asshole. So I think in those ways, maybe they're also similar. But one of the areas where Elon stands out from Steve in a not necessarily positive way, as far as public perception is concerned, perhaps it is a positive thing for his ability to be effective. But that's just the love of and thriving in the chaos. And, you know, what Walter Isaacson has talked about as demon mode, that I think that is that characteristic has very high utility for Elon. And it is something that definitely allows him to get stuff done. But it also makes this whole thing a little bit more volatile, because I think he kind of likes it when he's at least a little bit hated. And so I think that will blunt the impact of him being an original in some regards, because I think he's going to stir the pot and be a little bit more of a troll, you know, a little bit more of, yeah, I mean, I guess troll's the best word for it. He's going to troll humanity while trying to do what he believes is best for humanity, the whole time. I think that was another point that, that Johnny made earlier.
But some people like that, though.
Some people do.
Joe Rogan talks about it. Like, Joe Rogan talks about, you know, like, we did that compilation. One of the highlights from that thing we did was, like, that Bill Gates meme, you know, if you want to lose a boner fast. And he was in a room full of comedians, and they loved that. They're like, we need more billionaires dunking on other people. Like, this is great, you know? He said it. He's my favorite billionaire. And the reason why I use Joe Rogan as an example is because he is unequivocally, objectively, the largest podcast in the world with the largest platform. And so he is that because he has garnered this reputation of appealing to the masses. And if you believe that the masses are reasonable people, then reasonable people will likely find what he is doing, right, at the very least interesting, at the very least, like let's say non-damaging, right? But there is a subset of the population that finds some of his actions damaging. But it's always moral. And this is why this whole thing is confusing, because it's always moral outrage, right? It's a subjective outrage. And that's what the Twitter thing has created in a way, you know? Is like there is a subset of the political spectrum that deem themselves to be of superior moral authority over Elon, and they can judge how his actions subjectively are good or bad, or his political viewpoints are good or bad. I'm not saying he hasn't made mistakes. He's obviously made mistakes, but oftentimes there are things, and I'm like, come on. Like, really, you really think that's really that bad? You know what I'm saying? Like, the whole discussion around the border, which I know was like a huge thing in the United States, that people were freaking out. It's like, how can you be so racist? And then Biden's like, yeah, close it down. Like, okay, so I guess he was right. Good thing you talked about it, right? I just find that stuff very interesting.
Observation about morals, I feel like, is a really good one. And it, you know, just kind of was a light bulb moment for me that Twitter, the purchase of Twitter, was essentially like the modern day equivalent of Martin Luther nailing his 95 theses to the cathedral doors. That, you know, social media in a lot of ways is the purveyor of cultural values and truth. Like, social media is today what the Catholic Church was in the 1500s. And Elon came in and said, yeah, I think the way that y'all are doing all of this is dumb, and we're going to hit the Etch-a-Sketch button and shake it all up. And that's going to be super uncomfortable for a lot of people. And, you know, I think that moral superiority was a massive part of the pushback that Martin Luther and just, you know, the Protestant Reformation in general received from the Catholic Church. Like, supposedly these are both people that believe roughly the same things ish. Like, the differences are relatively minor in the grand scheme of things. And yet the small differences are so consequential that, like, we've got to kill each other now over it and plunge Europe into literally hundreds of years worth of violence and wars between Christians over, you know, theological differences. And, like, that's, I think that is what social media has felt like for a while, was that, hey, if you defect even a little bit from these things that must be true, then we're going to kill you socially. And, yeah, like, I don't know. It's just kind of a weird correlation to think about. And I think as people who would like to believe that we're rational, since we live hundreds of years later than those dumb people from the ancient past. Yeah, it's like, no, we're the same exact things. We're the same people. And we've got some systems that are, at least some of our systems are a lot better than that. Some of them seem like they're the exact same. And yeah, I think that hopefully we can figure out some of that stuff and come to solutions that are much less destructive this time around than they have been in the past.
This whole thing in respects to Elon, X, Twitter, way more people being upset with him than it seemed before, at least way more vocal because of his politics, right? The, just the fascinating thing is all of it is a battle of whose morality is more important or better. And morality is emotional. It's an emotional, it's not objective, it's subjective. And the most fervent, like the most passionate people that want to paint it as objective are the most subjective by default, right? And that's why you have different religions. That's why you have different political parties, is because there's a spectrum of what morality, like whose morality is better, right? And it's like, you know, it's just so fascinating. And now you have an engineer, and like an autistic engineer saying, this is how you do it. You know, it's freaking, it's amazing. And the reason why I say autistic engineer is because people on the spectrum typically, I shouldn't say typically, probably almost always, they're not as concerned or perhaps cognizant of how that spectrum could influence someone's actions or someone's reactions to something that's in front of them, right? So you have somebody who's not really worried about that, trying to execute against the thing that is very much in that playing field. And then you have this murky thing where people are like, oh no, this guy totally is a piece of shit because he's obviously a terrible person because he thinks the border, he thinks there's an illegal invasion. I'm not saying yes or no. I'm not saying that's, if, I'm just saying like just that existing is going to create that chaos. And people that are investors get really uncomfortable because they're like, oh my God, here you go, stirring the pot. You're going to have a lot of people that are pissed off at you. They're not going to buy your products, you know? But clearly that's hasn't been the case because the best-selling car in the world in 2023 was a Tesla.
And the best-selling EV in China for the first half of this year, also Tesla Model Y, which is, you know, the biggest, most consequential car market in the world, whatever that's worth.
Nothing to those people, Hans. Nothing.
Well, let's take it back to the, in the context of all that, one of the things that is, I think, becoming increasingly, as Elon's influence grows and his ability to continue to execute on new technologies maintains its trajectory, that he sets impossible goals, he creates incredible teams, he executes on those impossible goals always later than expected, almost, with very, very few exceptions, either later or much later than originally hoped for. That person right now is leading the charge on three sets of technologies already. This doesn't even get into robotaxis. This doesn't even get into Optimus robots. Space technology with SpaceX bringing the cost of, you know, space travel down by orders of magnitude. EVs and artificial intelligence. That even if you say his contributions with XAI are, you know, limited and inconsequential compared to other players, the fact that he was a co-founder of OpenAI and they are where they are today on the back of his capital and vision and his foresight in this field. Like, if you just go back and listen to the things he was saying about artificial intelligence in 2010, obviously this person has understood where this was going long before other people and had thought about it at levels that other people had not. But anyways, these three technologies, these are three of the technology positions that are left that the United States actually has a leadership role in compared to China. That in so many other areas, China is handing us our butts. We talked about this with Michael Dunn, that their supply chains are deeper, their manufacturing prowess is better, and their workforce is more conscientious. Like, And these things are foundational elements of military might. And if we want to maintain our military edge against a regime that is a socialist dictatorship that does not have any qualms with using any and all means available to the government to squash dissent, it seems really important that we make sure that we have the types of people on our team doing the types of work necessary to maintain our lead against a regime like the CCP. I don't know that I would say that the CCP is evil.
You don't think they're evil?
I don't know. I would say that practically they have been an incredible force for good in the lives of much of the world. That commercializing access to technology and forcing the costs of things down and providing a much larger portion of the population than just fancy rich people who live in big cities and have fat paychecks. I think that that is a profoundly positive thing. And I think that they, more than any other regime, have contributed positively to that over the last few decades. Now, they are definitely totalitarian and, you know, I would never defend their actions toward the Uyghurs or, you know, any number of humanitarian violations that they have enacted. But if I say that, you know, all those things are true and I look at the United States, I would say that we are also equally as guilty of unjustified violence against people. It's just that instead of those people being inside of our country, we only do that to people outside of our country for the most part.
Facts.
And so, you know, I don't think any government is going to, like, what is a government? A government is a corporation in the limit with a monopoly on violence. If you have a monopoly on violence, you have blood on your hands, period, end of story. Every single government around the world across every age of history for all time is always going to be guilty on this front. So, but I, you know, would I want to live in China? No. I think that there's a competition that is set up between the ideas of the West and the ideas of the East right now that could be beneficial, like could continue. It has been beneficial for humanity as a whole. It's kept, it's maintained its healthiness because it is in dynamic tension with the West and with the ideas of the West. And I think as long as the West is healthy, I think that the CCP can continue to be, to provide net benefits to the world. I think if we lose our vitality and we lose our competitiveness against them, so this is not like the West needs to defeat and destroy China because they're evil. What I'm contending is that the West needs to be strong and healthy to help maintain dynamic tension and, going back to the original points we were making earlier today, checks and balances. But I think that the CCP is a positive check and balance against, like, honestly, the US was becoming pretty friggin' unhinged and crazy and diabolical over the last few decades. And part of that ability was the fact that we were unchecked as global powers. And, you know, if we look back with objective eyes at the actions that we took in the Middle East from the 70s onwards, it's pretty hard to defend our actions as anything other than self-serving and, you know, just like a new version of imperialism. And while I don't agree with most of the crazy rhetoric that says we just need to tear America down because we're this evil country, I would say that there's some seeds of truthful critique in their points on this front. And so I think that having someone like China be a strong competitor to us helps check us and keep us from being as crazy. And so I think that that's a good thing. So anyways, all of that to say that we need to have players here in the United States that are developing technology that will help keep us on an equal footing, at least, if not at an advantage position with the CCP we have Elon, we've got Palmer Luckey, and who? Like, who are the innovators? And Alex Karp at Palantir.
Hans. We have Kanye.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the fact that that's a part of the conversation really, you know, puts a pin on how ridiculous this is that we, you know, we don't have that many people that are having a major consequential positive impact on our global competitiveness. And we need to be celebrating these people up more, elevating them more, making it more culturally, whatever you want to say.
It's okay to say they're good.
Yeah, it's okay. Not only is it okay to say they're good, while flawed, 100%, but this is what people should aspire to. We need fewer Kim Kardashians and more Elon Musks. Not that I like Kim Kardashian's not an evil person, but Kim Kardashian's contributions to society as a whole are not as positive as Elon Musk's. Like, that should not be a controversial thing to say, that the person who is going to make space travel accessible to normal everyday people over the next 50 years is a much better person to be than Kim Kardashian.
Found my lead in for the video. What's the timestamp? 56:30. I 1000% agree. And I think if you think about the West, like the United States specifically, probably the West. I mean, I haven't lived in Europe since I was 12, so I can't say. And I'd love to hear in the comment section our European friends if they think this. But there's been a clear effort. And Jonathan Haidt was on the All In podcast a couple of days ago. I think yesterday he referenced this. It was in one of his books, where the West has been in this sort of state to, instead of try to bring the bottom up, they're trying to bring the top down, right? They're trying to vilify the top and bring them down to the lower levels to like say, hey, you evil piece of crap, come down to my level, right? Instead of like, wow, that is clearly a better place to be objectively, because you have more resources, more innovation, which creates more jobs and better outcomes for people. And people are healthier because they're happier, they're more fulfilled, and that creates a flywheel of success. The more success there is, the more success gets created, which creates more success, so on and so forth, right? So you start bringing I'm a perfect example of this. If I use myself as an example, my parents immigrated to the United States when I was 12 in search for a better life. They came here with basically nothing. They had to claw and scratch and bleed and cry and all kinds of crazy stuff to give my brother and I a life where we can capitalize on the opportunities that were given to us. And because the United States in the past has created this flywheel of success, I've been able to find my place. You know, my brother has been able to find his place, right? And my parents have been able to find their place, and their outcomes are significantly better because of that, right? Once we start like attacking the top, which you know, like it or not, created those situations. That's how capitalism works. One of the strengths of capitalism is to create this sort of environment that we're in. If the people that prove why capitalism is a net benefit start getting attacked, and we stop celebrating those people in a way, and we start vilifying everything they do, and we say, hey, these people are bad, then what is the incentive for anybody to do better? What is the incentive for society to get better, right? Like, it just creates the scenario where we're all just going to be like, okay, everything's fine. Like, let's not get any better. Everything's fine. And then to your point, China's going to be like, okay, they're just chilling. They're just chilling. And we have our mandate, right or wrong, Xi Jinping, his mandate is China's going to rule the world, and I'm going to facilitate it so that industry, we dominate through industry, we dominate through manufacturing, we're going to make our military 100 times greater and more powerful, we're going to leverage our 1.3 billion person population, and we're going to get there. And, you know, on the other side, they're going to have to fix their long-term issues with their fertility, right? Because, you know, it's an aging population. So that's an issue they're fighting. That's where we're kind of like, the immigrants thing is kind of a positive, because our, in a weird way, all the illegal immigrants that came into our country in the last couple of years has helped with the age of the country, but that's a separate discussion, which is kind of like an interesting thing to think about. But like, that's where we're at, right? And that's the battle. And so to say, and like your point of like, we need more Elon Musks instead of Kim Kardashians is 1,000% accurate. And that's why, like, you know, I know the two of us are not afraid to say Elon is a good for society, specifically because of what you said. There's more than just like, oh, he's a cool guy, I want to support him. It's like, no, like him and 10,000, a million other entrepreneurs that are out there, you know, that symbolize this sort of like, hey, this is why capitalism rocks, this is why America rocks, is because we have the maximum amount of opportunity to bring our talents forward to benefit society. Like, these are the people we should be figuring out how to empower them within limits, right? Ensure that they're within the limits of laws and ensuring that they're not causing more harm than good. And how do we create an environment where the rest of the population is like, fuck yeah, I want to do that, right? How do we do that?
Yeah, it's a really hard, I agree. Like, it's a really hard thing to get right, because, you know, I think you can set up a system where it can be right for a while, but then that system, like, as you execute on those goals, then you start to build in things through your success that lead to the failure of that system over a long period of time. And that's why, you know, no empire has ever lasted indefinitely. They all fall, and ours will fall as well. And, you know, part of the rise and fall of empires is this very issue. I think this is really one of the core issues that the rise and fall of empires hinges upon, is can you incentivize the, you know, what percentage of your population can you incentivize to be an entrepreneur who tirelessly works for the benefit of others, not because they're generous, but because they're selfish.
What are the incentives? 100%. And so let's take it to a weird fucking place, okay? So right now, capitalism, the incentive for a majority of the population is money. Money, right? The incentive is you make great stuff, people will buy, you get more money, you create jobs, which increases the pool of money out there. And, you know, because money, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. I think this is where a lot of people, like, think about money and the economy as a zero-sum game. Is like, okay, there's a finite number of dollars in value in the world, and it's the redistribution of that value or money that makes somebody rich or not. But in reality is the economy and money is a function of the inventions that humans can bring out of thin air, which are quasi infinite, right? So it's like, I almost think of it as like, there is money in a separate dimension that is sitting there. This is reality. And there's another dimension where there is the maximum amount of money that could be in this dimension, right? And that money comes in by the different jobs and products and innovations that we create. And that bubble of the dimension with money is like a trillion times bigger than our current dimension. And we just haven't figured out how to funnel that money in yet, right? And so how do you bring that money in? Innovation. You bring it through great products, great services, right? And so if that's true, then theoretically, everybody can be rich. Theoretically, everybody can be rich, right? Relatively speaking to this time. Then you get into a question of like inflation, blah, blah, blah. Like, we, you know, that's, I don't want to get into that math right now. But so let me make this point real quick. What the fuck happens when the bots are here? The incentive goes away. The incentive to make money goes away.
Does it? You know, I don't know. The way that you think about that is very odd to me, but.
You're welcome.
There's utility, and I it's kind of actually not far wrong. I think people should, I'll plug them again, read The Rational Optimist and How Innovation Works by Matt Ridley. They are phenomenal at helping people to understand what we're talking about is technology, that, you know, what money is a scorecard for time. That's really like, it's a scorecard for human time. The thing that technology gives us is the ability to do more stuff with less time. So, for example, the amount of light that you can have in your house or an hour's worth of labor today is thousands of times more than you could have provided when the technology that we had to produce the light was lard candles and wicks. Like, it's just not very efficient to create light with wicks and tallow or whatever, you know, whale fat or whatever it is that you're using. And so if you can figure out a technology that allows you to create that product with less stuff, then all of a sudden, the fact that that is, it takes less of your time to earn enough to have that light makes your day more productive. You don't have to spend, like, you can spend more of your time doing other things when you're not spending it trying just to have enough light to be able to read in the evening. And, you know, every technology is essentially that story just told over and over and over again. How do we get more of something that's useful with less input of resources? And so the more that we, like, the more that the technology advances, the less human time and energy we have to spend to get the stuff. The bot is where, like, that's where all of a sudden this thing starts to break. Like, when the bots do all the work to generate the stuff, what does an economy even look like? And that's why Elon asked this question. Because I personally think that humans are still going to want to have a scorecard. And, you know, just like computers are better than humans at chess. Do humans still play chess? Yeah, they do. Why? Because they like it. Yeah. And it's a way for humans to compete against each other. And the best humans can have this cool thing we call status. And the fact that status can be acquired is the reason to play the game. And so I think we're still going to have games like that, where people can get status and win social points and be able to score with hot babes. Like, I don't think that part's going away.
You know what's super fascinating about what you just said? So I was I spoke with Phidias. I hope I'm not butchering his name, but he's a very large YouTuber. He has a podcast as well. He had me on his podcast. Shout out Phidias. And the one question he proposed, which was very fascinating, like, I still think about it to this day. You know, the example he used is like, hey, I'm a very successful YouTuber. I'm in my very small country. I am one of the wealthiest, most famous people in my country. Okay. And I have all the resources necessary and to me, like, that I could ever use. Right. And so this got me thinking is like, when I walk to a restaurant, everybody knows me. When I walk to a place, everybody knows me. And I just get stuff for free. I have all the resources in the world, but I could just get stuff for free. I don't ask for it. It's just given to me because I have that status, because I'm known. I'm a person, right? So what is an analogy we can use for the, like, a bot world, right? Where money is no longer an issue. How about the top 1% of the population? How about the top 1% of the top 1% of the population in the United States, let's say? Like, the million people that live here where money is truly not an issue, or whatever, 10 million people, whatever that number is, right? When those people don't worry about money, like, why are they doing what they're doing, right? Why are they doing what they're doing? Is it status? Is it power? Is it passion? Is it social responsibility? Is it moral responsibility? Right? That's what's going to be like. I wish I could do a Twitter poll or X poll targeted to those top 1 million richest people. And I'd be like, why do you still work? Why do you still work? And I think that answer will be the proportionality of that answer, whatever those buckets are, I think will be the answer of what society will look like with humanoid robots and artificial intelligence. And that's the society that, and like, that's how we should think about society. I think, I don't know. What you think?
I like
a stupid
the
idea,
but I think that there's an assumption that those people know why they're doing what they're doing. And I don't think that's true. I think that's bullshit. I think that we tell ourselves stories about why we do what we do, that are 90% crap. And so I think trying to get to what that actual reason is much more difficult than running a poll.
Anonymous poll, though. Anonymous.
Much more difficult than running an anonymous poll. Even it doesn't matter how many old people that you call at home to do your anonymous poll. I don't think you're.
That's true. That's fair enough. And you know that subset of the population probably has biases and tendencies. Like they are cut from a cloth that will probably answer the question somewhat similarly. Whereas if you pose that same question to say the middle 80% of society or the middle 60%, it becomes a very. So yeah, it's like this is why it's so hard to figure out where we're going.
Let's look at Elon as an example. And I'll do some, you know, armchair psychologizing and say, I think
what's
that
your rate?
$95. I think that my assumption about Elon is that the reason that he does what he does is because of scars from his childhood. And I think that's honestly going to be the real answer behind the vast majority of highly successful people, that they get stuck in a loop of trying to solve a problem that they could not solve for themselves as children. And they are able to find a solution in adulthood that works for them to solve the feeling of fear that they felt as a child. And then that just becomes a flywheel of self-reinforcing stuff that propels them into success, but never actually solves the problem. And I think, you know, when those people finally get healthy and well-adjusted, all of a sudden they stop doing all the crazy stuff that makes them so, like, they're not able to continue to do those things anymore. Like, I think Elon's ability, for example, to work 12-hour days, 7 days a week or more for decades on end is not because he's healthy. I think that's because he's fucked up.
Trauma. Yeah. How else do you build that shield and that engine without trauma? I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, and when I think about, like, I posed this question to Walter Isaacson when I interviewed him on the Elon biography on Spaces. I was like, oh no, it was before, it was in a space he did with somebody else, and I got to ask him a question, which was awesome. I asked him, you know, one of the things you said is that, you know, Elon had a tough childhood. If you think about all the great people that you've written the biographies for, so he did Albert Einstein, he did Steve Jobs, he did Leonardo da Vinci. Was childhood trauma a commonality? And he's like, absolutely. 100% is a commonality. And it makes perfect sense. You know, diamonds are made, you know, with pressure. The phoenix rises from the ashes, right? Like, how many different, like, ways of describing the, you know, from you know, no pain, no gain. No pain, no gain, right? It's 1,000% true. I use myself as an example. My childhood wasn't the easiest childhood in the world. You know, we moved a lot, came to the States at 12, not knowing any English. At my peak of my puberty, I couldn't talk to girls, you know? I was stuck at home trying to fit into a new place. I always needed, like, I needed to prove myself, right? So it, there was certain circumstances that led me to end up where I'm at now. And I'm not saying I'm like this incredible person. I'm just saying, like, if I think about my life deeply, without the challenges I had as a child, I wouldn't be able to achieve what I've achieved today, you know? And I think that probably rings true with a huge majority of the population, you know? And that's such a fascinating thing to think about, because you're like, okay, what percentage of the population has gone through trauma that's, like, material enough for them to do some good in the world that fuels the creation of good in the world in the future? And I'm willing to bet a majority of the world is really fucked up. Like, a majority of 100%. Humans are, yeah, really, like, human suffering is such a common theme across humanity, you know? And, like, what I get so excited about, Hans, this is where, like, I become extremely optimistic about the future. What happens when the societies that have traditionally been disconnected from the world's economy in third world countries and even second world countries, or like the folks that haven't been able to dig themselves out of the lower rungs of society in first world countries, once they are enabled to reach their fullest potential by unlocking their time, what does the world look like? Because those people probably experience a lot of pain and suffering that they can channel, you know, that has built them and morphed them into a person that wants to do better through whatever those variables are, right? That's where I get really fucking exciting, because those people are about to, they're about to enter the world's economy through Starlink, through artificial intelligence, through robotics, through bot, and so on, innovation, you know, like that's where I get so excited.
It's such a hard and fascinating question to answer. One of the things that I'm thinking about as someone who lived for a significant amount of time in Africa, I'm thinking about a lady named Magat Wad who has a book called The Cheetah Generation. And so she's Senegalese, and she was able to, as a child, emigrate to France, and then from France emigrate to the United States, and became a successful entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. And, you know, she shares many of the positive qualities of many Africans and was able to use those in a place where she had opportunities to massive success, and then has tried to go home to Senegal and replicate those types of successes there in Africa. And it's so hard there right now, because as part of the independence movement that swept through Africa in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, and most of these nations were colonies of some Western country, you know, whether it was France or Britain or Germany or Belgium or whatever, that they declared their independence from these countries that were primarily mostly capitalistic. There was an association between capitalism and imperialism, and they all, and a lot of them also kind of propped up by socialist or communist independence movements as well, they really turned towards more socialistic types of governments, which is traditionally not the case for Africa. And the amount of regulation that entrepreneurs there in Africa have to go through to do things that are simple and easy here in the United States, and the challenges, like, you know, this is something that they would share with potentially Europe, where, you know, you can hire someone pretty easily in Europe. You can't necessarily fire that person very easy, and you're on the hook, you know, if you take that person's paycheck away. It's like that on steroids in Africa in many countries. And, you know, between that and the amount of regulators that you have to talk to do anything, it basically makes business impossible. And so I say all that to say this. I think that as we employ Optimus robots, we're going to have the opportunity to do two different types of social experiments. And one of them, the one that's going to come naturally to most people, is we want to socialize the benefits of this. We want to give stuff away to lots of people. And we want this bot army to be the magnanimous provider of all things that the people are going to need. Usually along with that comes a centralized system for distributing the things. And there's going to be a lot of people that's going to be the social experiment that they try, is essentially a socialist or communist or collectivist style social experiment to say, okay, here, this is what society looks like when we let the bots do the work and we provide the things to the people. If the people's freedom to do with whatever it is that they have, however it is that they got it, is restricted, I don't think that over the long term that experiment is going to turn out positively. I think it's going to have huge unintended consequences, and that it's not going to go well. The other hand is we can have bots help, you know, create amazing productivity, and we can have a system that aligns incentives much, much better. And, you know, is that capitalism? Is it something that's capitalism 2.0? What does that look like? I don't know. We've got to figure that out, but we need a whole different class of experiments that are in the capitalist-ish realm, not the socialist realm, so that we can have the counterpoints to those socialist style experiments. And I'm sure I'm using these terms a little bit loosely, and that's going to annoy a lot of people. And I'm sorry for that fact. You're just going to have to get on with your day, and you know, you can at me on Twitter. I'm just not going to respond.
It's not going to annoy them any more than you saying the CCP isn't purely evil.
I know. I'm trying to get myself canceled left and right today. You know what?
I love don't it. Care. Engagement farm. Let's go.
Woohoo. Yeah. So all of that said, I think that all of that's going to be interesting, and it's on the back of, you know, I think we tend to think of this abundance thing as like, oh my gosh, anyone can do anything that they want here on Earth. But remember, all of this is happening at the same time that we're about to start becoming a spacefaring species. And then I think a lot of the productivity gains that we're going to have are going to be channeled into an expansion of humanity, first into our solar system and then potentially beyond. And I think that our ability to generate resources is going to be matched by our ambitions to use those resources to go conquer more stuff, just like it has always been everywhere throughout human history.
So it's never going to stop. It's just going to be a different way of doing it, basically. We're going to have space lasers instead of sticks and stones.
Pretty much. I mean, that tends to be, and I'll, you know, just to be frank with everyone, part of this is driven by the fact that I have read the Bible a number of times, which in my view is a story of humanity and how humanity operates, on top of reading a whole lot of other books. And, you know, if you read enough history, what you come away with is that humans are going to human in any way and every way that they can, from, you know, the dawn of time until now. And I don't think that having space lasers instead of sticks and stones does much to change the monkeys that are wielding said weapons.
Monkeys with space lasers is a lot more scary than monkeys with sticks and stones. It's a lot more scary. And, you know, honestly, So as I'm thinking through, it's like, okay, how do we solve this? Like, who are the people out there that we can talk to where we can start throwing these ideas around, right? Like, to me, it's like, okay, like, an obvious one is the guy that's creating a lot of these technologies that are going to enable this future. So, like, if we can have Elon, like, not even to talk to him about Tesla or SpaceX, like, this is what I want to talk to the guy about. Because obviously, like, he's creating the industry around some of the things that will get us to that point. But like, okay, let's deep dive what it's going to look like, because we need to be prepared for the potential chaos. Like, there's no doubt it's going to be a positive, but like, help us create paint a more concrete picture of what that future is going to look like, so we can start like preparing for it in a way. Who else? Like, who else would you talk to?
How much does talking about it help? And this is a dumb question for me to ask as someone who really enjoys talking about it, to try and figure out what's going to happen. A lot, Hans.
You
get
views and likes, bro. Come on. but here's like, dude, like, I'm telling you, like, it's funny that we're bringing this up now, that Phidias conversation I was talking about earlier. And this is like, somebody mentioned this on X today. I think it was Balaji. I forget which account it was. But the currency could very well be what's underneath this video. If you don't have it on landscape mode, if you have it in portrait mode, and you can see the like count and the subscribe count. Is that the new currency?
Yeah, well, I definitely think that. So going back to one of the points that we were making earlier, status is going to be a huge thing moving forward. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that this era of social media has really put a spotlight onto, is that the humans that are good at capturing the attention of other humans obviously have a relative status thing going for them. That is, I think that's going to get continue to be amplified moving forward. So I would agree with that.
So everybody should really start a YouTube channel or an X account, like, pronto. Honestly, if that's the truth.
Yes, but they should. So they should do that at the same time that they do one other thing, and that's to get really curious about something that honestly fascinates them to no end and go deep down the rabbit hole more so than anyone else has gone down it. Because one of the things that it seems like with a lot of the, especially we'll say the digital natives, the Zoomers and below who have grown up with social media, is that they look at people who are huge on social media and they want to be like them. And so they just try to take the short route straight to that. And what they don't see as a young person is, you know, how did Joe Rogan, who is not who the Zoomers are looking at, but who were looking
Logan
at.
Logan Paul.
Yeah. You know, how did they get to be who they are? Most of them, the ones who have staying power, who are actually able to be figures over long periods of time, it's because there's a lot of effort and network connections and domain expertise and in all kinds of, like, there's a lot of work underneath the hood of what it takes to be successful initially and then sustain that success over time. And so, yeah, I think that I just want to encourage people, like, if you want to be someone that people like, likes, subscribes, all that stuff, all that is just a proxy of people want to hear what it is that I have to say. If people want to hear what it is that I have to say, hopefully it's because they find value in it. Hopefully it's not just because you're pissing them off left, right, and center all day long, unlike this guy. And to do that, you need to understand something that they don't understand. How do you understand something that other people don't understand? You do more research on that thing than they do. And especially if it's something that they need to know more about, but don't. And so anyways, that's my short little rant on why you shouldn't just be a social media person. You should be a social media person who's an iceberg, where what it is that you have to say in any given interaction is the tiny little piece sitting on top of a mountain of expertise and experience below that. Because that will serve you much better in the long run.
Yeah. Like how can you get yourself where you can do a 30-second TikTok or X video that gets a ton of reach, but then you can also do a 4-hour long form podcast on the same exact topic? Like that's how I think about it. And those two are very different things, because one of them is like, how do you compress the information down so that the masses can understand it? And the other one is how well informed are you about the details that frame that expertise, and how deeply can you talk about their benefits, and how well can you steel man the other side? Right. That's how you really arrive to true expertise. Or we could be wrong, or it's something completely different. You know, this is why, if in the comment section, if you've made it this far,
you could just make TikToks and have a juicy booty.
OnlyFans. Oh, dude, what was the one thing? I was listening to the one All In podcast. There is less people going to strip clubs lately, and that's like a sign of like a slowing economy.
The stripper and then index.
And then Friedberg was like, that's because OnlyFans, you can have a strip club in your bathroom or whatever, in your bedroom, right? Like, you don't need to go to a strip club anymore. It's like, it's just moved over to OnlyFans. Anyway, but it talks about, okay, but isn't that another data point that says, yeah, that's where we're going, right? That's just like the more female-dominated field, like a subset of the female influence bubble. I want to get myself
Arzad's
in trouble.
Arzad's trying to get himself canceled now, too.
Okay, let's end the podcast. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a fantastic weekend. Bye, everybody. So should we? I think we should end. It's an hour and a half. I mean, it's been fucking fire the whole time, I feel like. What do you think?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah. Let me do an intro for the Johnny Harris thing, because I don't think we gave enough context.
No. Yeah, like the beginning was slow. I feel like we definitely, yeah, especially after our conversation, we can't have the conversation with David that we had yesterday and then just not,
yeah,
have a banger intro today.
Yeah, 100%. I'm gonna record this anyway to see if I can flow it into the conversation. All right, so Hans and I are
about- Do you wanna Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I didn't understand. I thought you were saying you were.
I'm gonna do it now.
Record it afterward.
Yeah, I'm gonna do it now.
I'm gonna shut
up. All right. All right, here we go. All right, so we're gonna start talking about the terrible intro. All right, so we're about to start
outtakes.
This is gonna go at the very end of the video. All right. Okay, so we're gonna start talking. What am I gonna say? You know,
is it that you don't know what to say, or is it that I keep distracting you with my ridiculous?
No,
face?
I literally don't know what to say. Like, okay, Johnny Harris made this video about Elon Musk. He gets into a bunch of,
Say Johnny Harris is a fucking asshole, and I can't believe he came out with this bullshit video, and we're gonna talk about it.
Watch this. Great. All right. Fuck it. That's great. Oh, that's great. All right. I'm using that. Are you okay with that?
Well, no, we can't really use that because that will totally get flagged by YouTube to have that much swearing in the intro.
I'm just going to bleep it out.
Okay.
Are you comfortable with it?
I guess. Why not?
Fuck it. Why not? All right. Nice. I'm going to leave this whole thing for people to see at the end just so you can see the creative process. Yeah. All right. Okay. I'm going to end recording now for real.
That's going to be one of my favorite new things that we do. Like, I don't know why it just hit me to do that the other day. And I meant to ask David. That's the one thing I forgot. I'm curious what he thinks about it or if he even encountered it yet. Does he even know?
What? I don't think he saw it.
Yeah.
We'll test him. Okay, David. We'll see. Have you seen this? And if so, send us a Discord message that says, I hate England. I hope they lose to Spain. There you go.
He's not going to send that either way.
Fuck him. Vamos España. All right. Now we're going to end it for real now. There we go.